Okay, when we left off last time, we transitioned from laws concerning theft and destruction of property to personal injury matters. We talked about accidents and negligence and the case laws and the distinctions that were made there. And particularly, we talked about how, you know, you do some physical harm to someone else, then, you know, you're responsible to make that right proportionately. And what we haven't talked about yet then is actual murder. What is the proper penalty for murder? Given what we said thus far about the basic biblical principle is, as you have done, so it shall be done to you. The thought is, if you kill me, then the proper thing would be me to kill you, right? Well, I can't do that. I'm dead, okay? So how does that work out, okay? The Bible says, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, life for life. The proper penalty for murder in the Bible is the death penalty. It's capital punishment. It's the proportionate punishment. Now, because whenever you get into this, the matter of capital punishment, there's usually a lot of contention surrounding it, whether it should still be in effect or not. A rationale and a defense of, I think, capital punishment is appropriate. Okay? So, today, what I want to do is kind of just do that, kind of look at the basis for capital punishment, at least in regard to murder, and sort of trace this theme throughout Scripture and see something of the rationale for it. Okay? So with that in mind, Roman number one, the death penalty and the Noahic covenant. It's important we point out that the death penalty is first set forth in Genesis chapter 9, right after the flood. Now, if we look at the chronology of Genesis 5, which takes us from Adam down to Noah, there's over 1,600 years that transpire from Adam, from the creation to the flood. During this time, there was no capital punishment. Okay, Cain kills Abel, but no one is permitted to execute him in response. Okay, in fact, a mark is placed on him, prohibiting anyone from executing him. And so it's significant to point out that for a long time there was no capital punishment. And I think the reason for that is man was not yet mature enough to handle such an important responsibility. You don't give the car keys to an 8-year-old, right? You don't allow someone 4 years old, you know, to drink, you know, whatever. You know, here's a bottle of whiskey. Drink, be moderate, right? Doesn't work that way. And I think that's kind of what's going on here. After the flood, God first initiates capital punishment only in regard to murder. Okay? Nothing else but murder. To understand why, think about this. God creates the world. He made it originally formless and void, right? It's this big ball of water. Then he goes about shaping it up each day, transforming it the first 3 days, making the sky and seas, light and dark, the dry land appear, all that sort of stuff. So that by the end of day 3, it's no longer formless. But it's still void. It's still empty. So days 4 to 6, he starts filling it up with the birds, the fish, plants, animals, man, etc. So that by the end of day 6, it's no longer empty either. So at day six, God says it's very good. God brought it, the world, from glory to glory. And on the sixth day, he creates man in his image. And at this point, what does that mean to be made in the image of God? Well, you're a being who works and who takes things that are made and transforms it. Now, that's what Adam and Eve are supposed to do. They're supposed to have dominion over the earth, be fruitful, multiply, build community. And this community of humanity is to spread across the face of the globe and transform the world over the course of time. What happened, though, because of sin, was instead of the world getting better, it got worse. Until we come to the flood narrative, and we're told that the earth was filled with wickedness. Things had gotten bad instead of good. And so what God does is he basically starts over. He makes the world formless and void again. He covers it all back up again with water. So after the flood, Noah, the ark, land on the mountains of Ararat, and it's kind of like a new start for humanity. And God tells Noah and his family, be fruitful and multiply. So we're starting all over here. Now, to ensure that things don't go the way they did before, now God is going to trust humanity with this new responsibility of helping curb violence and wickedness himself. Okay? Now before, when you were a child, I took care of everything itself. Now you're a little older, I'm entrusting you with some responsibility. And that responsibility was the capital punishment. New privileges, new responsibilities. Man has reached a new level of maturity over the course of time, and now he's entrusted with new tasks. Okay? So that seems to be the reason why it's not established until we get to the flood. And again, it's only in regard to murder. And I'm just going to read in Genesis 9:6. Says, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. You see that same principle that we find throughout the rest of Scripture that will be made clear later on. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, life for life. As you have done, so it shall be done to you. Okay? The punishment fits the crime. Okay? There's the principle. And so that's the beginning of capital punishment. It's very significant to point out that capital punishment begins with Noah. And the reason why is when we think of Old Testament law, most of the time we think about the Mosaic law with its detailed lists of crimes and punishments and so on. The result is a lot of times when you come to the New Testament, you'll hear a lot of people believe that God has abrogated capital punishment. You hear a lot of Christians who seem to think it's barbaric. That it's part of the outdated Mosaic law code that has been abrogated. Just as circumcision, the dietary laws, animal sacrifices have been abrogated. See, there's all sorts of aspects of the Mosaic law we no longer practice. We don't have animal sacrifices, temple priesthood. All those things are done away with. And a lot of people think, well, that is the case in the New Testament as well. And the proof of that is the woman taken in adultery. And we'll deal with the woman taken in adultery later. But what I want to point out right now is that whatever you think about the Mosaic law is really irrelevant when it comes to capital punishment, because capital punishment was not established with the Mosaic law. It was established under Noah long before the Mosaic law was ever put into effect. Okay? Moreover, from Noah to Abraham, it's going to be about 400 years. And during all this time, there's no distinction between Jew and Gentile. It's not until God calls Abraham out and says, I'm going to make you another nation separate from all the nations of the earth, and I'm going to give you this sign of circumcision, etc. It's not until then that humanity begins to be divided between what will eventually become Jew and Gentile. Okay? So the point is, under the Noahic covenant, God is dealing with humanity as a whole. The legislation that comes under Noah is universal in nature. It's not something that's limited to the nation of Israel. So when you come to the new covenant, and we recognize there are aspects of the Mosaic law that are done away with because they were particular to Israel, well, that really has no bearing on capital punishment, because capital punishment predates the Mosaic law, at least in regard to murder. Okay? We're going to see God's going to expand the things for which someone might be executed under the Mosaic law. But under Noah, he gives the authority to administer capital punishment for murder. Okay? Long before there is any distinction between humanity and Jew and Gentile, and long before there's any Mosaic law with some features unique to Israel. That's very important. Any questions or comments right there? Yes, sir.
I suppose you probably get there. Where exactly does it institute the capital punishment?
Excuse me?
So I suppose you're going to get to, but where exactly does it institute capital punishment with Noah?
Oh, sorry. Genesis 9:6. Genesis 9:6. And so, verse 1, God blessed Noah and his sons, said to them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, etc. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast, on every bird of the air, etc. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you, so on. And then, from the hand of every man's brother, I will require the life of man. And he says, whoever sheds man's blood, by man's blood shall be shed. For in the image of God, he made man. Okay? So it's after the flood. Now, God institutes capital punishment. Okay, look at the second page of your notes then. So what I'm saying here is that forget what you think about the continuing validity of the Mosaic Law. I've been trying to demonstrate that Mosaic Law is also applicable in principle. It doesn't come over directly, but the principles of Mosaic Law continue. But it's important to point out that capital punishment is not established with the Mosaic Law. It predates it by over 1,000 years. In the case of murder. In addition to that, I want us to see that the stipulations of the Noahic covenant, the covenant made with Noah, continue to this day. Okay? We know the seasons. God promised he was going to maintain the seasons after the flood. Well, that's been going on for, you know, ever since then. Okay? Days are getting shorter now. It's getting a little bit cooler. We've had a wonderful August. That continues to this day. The permission to eat meat, I think everyone here is a carnivore. We all eat meat. The promise of no future, global flood. Those promises are still in effect, and they applied not just to Noah and his family. They apply to all humanity following. Okay, they're not provisions limited to some ethnic group, and so It's just really important to stress this, because so often people say, well, all these aspects of the Mosaic Law have been done away with, and given what Jesus says in regard to the woman taken in adultery, capital punishment is one of those things. It doesn't follow from that, because capital punishment was not established under the Mosaic Law. Okay? If you think about this, the rationale for it is, for in the image of God, He made man. That's as true today as it was in the days of Noah. All indications are, at least for murder, capital punishment is still the proper penalty for murder. It's the reciprocal punishment fits the crime. Okay. Now, when you come to the Mosaic Law, and like I said, there's a little debate about the chronologies of Genesis 5 and 11. There are some differences between what the Hebrew text and the Septuagint. If we use the Hebrew text, you'll see from the creation of Adam to the flood is 1,656 years. From the creation of Adam down to Abraham is 2,000. Abraham's call is 2,008 years. So you're looking at 350 years between the flood and Abraham. Okay, so you're about 2,000 years from Adam to Abraham's call, and then another 430 years to the giving of the law. And so from Abraham down to the giving of the Mosaic Law at another 430 years. And now you're looking at, 800 years something like that from Noah to the Mosaic Law. When God establishes the nation of Israel at Mount Sinai, He begins to expand the reasons for which capital punishment may be administered. Then, 40 years later, when God renews covenant with Israel, before they go into the land, then He gives more stipulations for which someone may be executed. Under the Mosaic Law, there are 18 different things for which a person might lose their life. Not necessarily, but might lose their life. And in your Roman numeral 2, letter A, I have all those things listed. Okay? We see that. We see all these things for which a person can be executed. And we think, man, they must have just, had an assembly line. Executing people left and right. That is not the case for several reasons. First of all, remember, the only thing that mandated capital punishment was murder. In regard to many other things, always remember, the victim had the right to determine the punishment up to the limits of the law. Remember, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, life for life. You cannot go above that. That's the great thing about tooth for tooth, etc., is like, I can't ask for 10 of your teeth. That put a limit on it. That restricted vengeance to a degree. If I want to be lenient, I can. I can accept a monetary payment. After, what good is it going to do me to knock out your tooth now that I'm missing a tooth? You pay for my dental bill. Like I said, most matters would be handled in that sort of way. There would be usually a monetary compensation for the wrong that is done. So let's say, for example, you kidnap me. And you hold me for ransom, and you're found, and you are convicted, I can ask for your death because kidnapping is a capital offense. Or I might, depending on your treatment of me, depending upon maybe I was sympathetic towards you. Maybe let's say that one of your captors treats you kindly and the other two don't. Okay? If I want to be sympathetic, if I want to be merciful, I might ask for monetary payment. Okay? I could say I just forgive you if I want. Yeah, I think something, you know, a situation like that, well, there's all kinds of variables and hypotheticals and all that, so I don't want to say, but there was incentive for leniency in many cases, all right? And so the fact that capital punishment was extended to other things doesn't mean that people were being executed left and right. Only murder required the person to be executed. No recompense was allowed in the form of a monetary payment. One of the reasons for that is because the murder of another one is not only attack on an individual, it's also attack on God. The rationale: for in the image of God, he made man. That's what's first given. So God is being attacked there as well. Okay? A little aside, if you look at our culture of death today and abortion, the Bible says, all those who hate me love death. People want to end the image of God. You know, if they hate God, they're going to hate his image. And it will create a culture of death. Okay? That's sort of the idea. Okay? So the list of capital crimes in the Mosaic Law is very extensive. But that doesn't mean everybody would be executed for each of these things. Also, we got to remember the two or three witnesses, all that sort of stuff. Beyond that, people sometimes will still think capital punishment is somehow barbaric. But we should always remember, God instituted capital punishment and enforced it even on his son. Okay? You see in the cross of Christ the administration of capital punishment. We think too lightly of sin oftentimes to really appreciate it. Beyond that, added to it, capital punishment is a deterrent. Now there's all sorts of debates about this in the literature on capital punishment. And the debates that go on in our culture over it, whether it's a deterrent or not. And you will hear some of these studies sometimes that come out and say there's no proof that capital punishment is a deterrent. You know, inmates they are interviewed. Did you know that when you did this, here was the potential, that you might be executed? Yes, and it didn't stop you. Sometimes studies are done about comparing states where capital punishment is enacted in comparison to states where capital punishment is not enacted. And it says, see, there's no proof that it's a deterrent. The Bible tells us it is. Okay? And we see this in a couple places. In Deuteronomy 13:11 says, so this is, somebody has done something that deserving a death, he's executed, and says, so all Israel shall hear in fear and not again do such wickedness as this among you. We see the same thing in chapter 17 in verse 13, and all the people shall hear in fear and no longer act presumptuously. You execute someone for doing this, others are going to get the message. Okay? All Israel shall hear in fear. So that, for me, that settles it, that capital punishment is a deterrent. So rather than having just bloodshed left and right all the time, actually, some people are going to get the message. Not everyone. There is always going to be that person who thinks they're going to get away with it. But many will think, hey, I don't want to do this. Okay, because that could be me. The thing is, though, it has to be properly administered. Okay? What I mean by that is this. Today, how is capital punishment administered? If I murdered someone today and I was apprehended, put in jail, probably be what, a couple years before the trial begins? Say I'm convicted and sentenced to death rather than life imprisonment. Well, I've got all kinds of years of appeals that I can make. And there will be court-appointed attorneys who will make that, and there'll be ACLU attorneys trying to keep me from getting executed. So if I do get executed, it's probably going to be another 20 years before it happens, okay, that I will spend in jail. It's something crazy like that. I mean, it's decades usually go by before someone is executed. I think Texas, maybe Georgia, does a little bit better job of doing that. But it's pretty typical that this just goes on and on. When a person is executed, it's always done behind closed doors. You have the family, you know, of the deceased, maybe a reporter, the prison officials, chaplain. There's a half dozen people. Okay. Here's kind of a debate that goes on. Said, well, if we want it to be a deterrent, this is what opponents of capital punishment say. Well, then make it public. Of course, everybody today is appalled at such a notion. But in biblical law, it was public. Okay? And you know, we look back at the old West, you know, you always see it in the movies, they build the scaffold there. I always wonder in the movies, why do they have to build a new one for, you know, the guy to be hanged? I would think they'd have one set up, you know, like you'd use it more than once or whatever. But there's always this guy, you know, and he's got this mask on, so nobody will see him do it, you know. No, he's the executioner. In biblical law, the victim's kin and the witnesses, those are the people throwing the first stones. Okay? And then the community joins in on it. And there's a pile of stones left there as a reminder. This is what happens when you do these sort of things. So to my point in regard to deterrence, in regard to my point about deterrence, maybe our studies are flawed because of the way capital punishment is generally performed today in our country. What if the guy was convicted beyond a shadow of a doubt and you took him from the courthouse to the field out back? Am I barbaric now? Antiquated? What about society? What about the murders that might then be avoided if other people said, they take this stuff seriously. You got something, Paul?
Can you speak just a little bit about how in Israel, if you had a child that was rebellious, they could be stoned, that's not a case of murder. And I would guess that the prodigal son was a candidate for that.
Yeah, let me say, there's one of those, this is a classic case in point. Where people, that prompts people to think about the barbaric nature of the Mosaic Law. Never mind, this is The Mosaic Law came from God. It was Israel's wisdom in the sight of the nations. And the psalmist says, oh, how I love thy law. It is my meditation all the day. We still, in our minds, we think that kind of stuff is barbaric. Let me say this. In regard to the matter of the rebellious son, it's not just a child, okay? The case law says the parents take the son to the elders of the city. And they say, this son of ours is a glutton and a drunkard. And neither of which were crimes in ancient Israel. They were sins, but you didn't punish someone if they were gluttonous or drunk. That was sin. It's like covetousness. There's no penalty for covetousness. But they said, we try to correct him, and again and again, it doesn't work. So this is someone who's old enough to be a drunkard. And they have repeatedly tried to correct him. And in gluttony, by the way, in the Bible, isn't overeating. What's the word? A profligate? Living. It's excessive living in excess. It's always associated with laziness and just living above your means and all those sorts of things. And so the crime for which he is executed isn't gluttony, it isn't drunkenness, it's contumacy. That's a word you don't hear a lot, but that's the only thing for which a person can be excommunicated is contumacy. That's persistent rebellion to authority. It's being unrepentant. So like you could do anything. You go out and murder somebody tomorrow and forgive me, we as a church can't excommunicate you. Okay? It's that refusal to repent that is always the basis of excommunication. A few years back we had a pastor who ended up in an adulterous relationship with a woman he was counseling, and the members of Presbytery went and confronted him, and he left his wife for this woman. And he was ultimately excommunicated for his contumacy, his unrepentant nature. And so I do want to say, there's a person who's obviously repeat offender and will not be corrected. Now, I don't think very many parents would have even done that. It's interesting to note, we have no record of anyone ever doing that in ancient Israel. And knowing what you know of parents, usually they are not going to do something like that. You know, here's my child, and the odds of that happening, I think, were probably very, very few that the parents would ever take their child to do that. But even then, it was this continual, persistent, unrepentant rebellion. And that, too, is merciful when you consider how many times in our culture today somebody kills somebody, and then it's like, oh, surprise, surprise. Well, they had a rap sheet this long. They've been out of jail for 12 years. They committed this crime, this crime, this crime, this crime. It was only a matter of time they're going to kill somebody. If we did more of that, there'd be a lot less of those continual repeat offenders that become hardened and commit worse crimes.
So that wasn't murder, but that was still allowed?
It was one of the 18 capital crimes, yeah. So let me make it clear. Murder was the only thing required capital punishment. These other things a person could be executed for, but not necessarily. And there again, I don't think most parents would take their child for that. In reality, okay, things would have to be pretty daggone bad, probably. Okay, so let's think about that in regard to our last point in regard to the deterrent effect of capital punishment if properly applied. Okay, if If we bristle at something in the Bible, it's a good chance the problem is with us and our sensibilities, or we don't understand the gracious nature of the law. You know, God's law is not burdensome. God's law is His burden is light. It's the way the transgressor is hard. And oftentimes we don't understand the principle behind the law if we bristle at it. We think it's harsh or something. Okay? Let's look at the third page there. Another thing that people often point out is the problem with capital punishment is that it always involves the risk of executing an innocent person. You can't hardly make that right. If I put you in jail for life and it comes to find out 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, some new evidence emerges that proves your innocence. I mean, you've lost some time off your life, but now you can be released and be an innocent man and you can correct the injustice to some extent. But you can never do that. If you execute an innocent man, then you can never go back and make a correction. And so that's oftentimes used as a rationale for not having capital punishment. It's important to note, though, that God understood this possibility when He initiated capital punishment, and it did not stop Him from doing so. And we have cases of innocent people being executed on trumped up charges in Scripture. Classic case is Naboth. Ahab wanted Naboth's vineyard. Remember, the law prohibited you from selling your land to another unless you were in poverty, and you got it back in the year of Jubilee. And Ahab's all been out of shape because he wanted Naboth's vineyard. Naboth must have grown some really good grapes and made some good wine, you know. And finally, Jezebel took matters into her own hands, got some scoundrels to trump up some charges on Naboth, and they had him executed so Ahab could take his property. Well, there's a case in point of an innocent man suffering the death penalty on trumped up charges. Well, God knew the possibility of that, but that still did not stop Him from establishing capital punishment. And so, to my point, I don't think we should think ourselves wiser than God. Remember what we said about injustice. We will never have perfect justice this side of heaven. And, you know, 4 billion years in eternity, I'm sure Naboth already got over it, you know. I mean, he's been in heaven for, you know, a few thousand years now. Okay? Yes, sir.
Seems like that's sort of a tactic of those that are opposed to things like people that are pro-choice. One of the first things they'll say, well, what about the woman who gets raped? You know, they always zero in on that real super small percentage of possibilities. You know, it's a null and void whatever they're trying to make. And so how do you, I mean, kind of answer it right there? I think in the grand scheme of things,
yeah, Ben Shapiro, I wish I have to look that up. Ben Shapiro has a real good response to that. I don't remember all of it, but first of all, you don't use the extreme case for the norm. But beyond that, I mean, if you argue for abortion in the case of of rape, I mean, that's like less than 2% of rapes, of abortions. I think it's like 1% or something, or less. For the reasons that abortion is performed. But basically, what you're saying is, it's the child that's being punished, not the rapist. You know, basically, we're going to kill the child because one of your parents sucked. You know, I mean, that's kind of the mentality there. It's like, well, you got a bad parent, so we're going to kill you. Well, it's not the child that did anything wrong. That child should be allowed to live. And I know of, and there are a number of pro-life people who are spokespeople who were the result of rape and who have kind of come out and said, hey, if this was allowed, if had my mom did this, I wouldn't have had my life, you know, and I don't deserve to be punished because of what my scum dad did. Okay. And I know of a young lady who, there was a lady that I knew way back when at the Bowen Center. She was raped and got pregnant from the rape. And another fella that started dating her later, they got married. He raised the child as his own. They went on. They had another child. But when you put a face on it, somebody alive, I think that makes a big difference. Okay. Yes, sir.
Going back to capital punishment, when, of course, circumstantial evidence, sometimes it's on rather obvious. You get several witnesses, they all collaborate, they all say yes, or they admit that they committed. But if it's in a biblical law, if it's under a situation where he said, they said, they conflict with each other, and there's, you don't go out just because a couple people say that somebody, you kill somebody. You go to the city of refuge and you work through that. Is that?
Well, yeah, I mean, those witnesses, and that's one of the witnesses have to testify. Can there be bad people like did it in regard to Naboth? Sure. But you got to remember also under biblical law in Deuteronomy 19 that if it turns out you are a false witness, whatever that was going to be done to that person will be done to you. So that was a way. So like if I'm a witness in regard to a theft of $5, and turns out that I perjure myself in that case, the punishment that would have happened to that person would be $10. And so that's, I would owe $10. Okay? But if it's a capital crime and I'm a witness, the punishment that would happen to that person is death. And so if it turns out that I'm a false witness, I'll be executed. See, the perjury is always in proportion to whatever would happen to the victim that I've perjured. So that would be a big detriment for anybody just coming out and lying about a murder, because I'm putting my life on the line in regard to that. And I've got to cast the first stone. I've got to stand up there with that rock and I've got to do it. Okay? I've got to look this person in the eye and do that. And that's why, that's part of the reason why the witnesses cast the first stone. And that's why when Jesus is saying, let he who was without fault cast the first stone, he's not saying, well, whichever one of you hadn't done anything wrong either. He's talking about if you violated a provision of the law, then you are disqualified as a witness. They said they caught the woman in adultery in the very act. They did not bring the man, but the law said both man and woman had to be brought before the judge. And so when Jesus says that, he's actually citing the law, the Pharisees recognize he's nailed them on it, and that's why they walk away one by one. Okay? Because they can be, having violated the law, they can be guilty of the law for what they've done. We'll look at the woman taken in adultery next time. All right, well, real quick then, Roman number 3, capital punishment today. Does it continue? Well, Romans 13, Paul says the civil magistrate has been given the power of the sword. They didn't use swords to spank people with. The sword was the typical Roman way of execution. He is sanctioning capital punishment even in the new covenant. Okay, at least for murder, possibly for other crimes. There's still debate going on. What about all those other things for which the Mosaic Law had endorsed capital punishment? There's some debate about some of those issues, how they would be enacted today. But certainly in the case of murder, I think we can say still. I think for other matters as well, but that's for another day. What about attempted murder? If you remember what we said before in the Bible, if you attempt something, that's the same as if you have done it. Okay? So if it was demonstrated, you took a shot and, you missed. And it's witnessed that you were shooting at so-and-so and his bullet whizzed by the person's head. Well, that's attempted murder. And you would be executed for having attempted it. You don't have to be successful. All you have to do is attempt murder. Okay? Now, so I'll just read a little quote from Vern Poitras here. What should we say about cases of attempted murder? The Mosaic Law does not speak directly concerning the penalty for attempted murder. Perhaps because it is difficult in many cases for judges to determine that a particular crime is attempted murder in distinction from attempt to cause serious injury. Okay, how do I know? I wasn't trying to kill him. I was just trying to, wing him or whatever. This case is therefore more doubtful in character. Deuteronomy 19:16-21 seems to indicate that the intention to do a thing, if legally demonstrable, constitutes guilt on the same level as the actual doing of it. On this basis, I deduce that attempted murder deserves the death penalty. As I've already observed in this and other cases, the maximum penalty is to be enforced only when A, the crime is legally demonstrable beyond reasonable doubt, B, there are no mitigating circumstances. Okay? Any other questions or comments? It especially has the context of a kind of a courtroom setting. Yeah. So here again, what we see in the case of capital punishment is that same principle: as you have done, so it shall be done to you. The punishment fits the crime in biblical law. And again, if we look at all the details of the text and what's required, you consider the provisions for leniency and a monetary compensation. When you consider that it has a deterring effect, etc., capital punishment, I think, is not the barbaric, antiquated thing that so many in our culture today want to make it out to be. And I would say a lot of Christians today are against capital punishment. And especially on the basis of the woman taken in adultery. They think that this is part of the old covenant legal system that is no longer in effect. And I just don't think that can be substantiated. I think it's biblical. The principles are there. Again, instead of being barbaric, I think it ought to be public. Any of y'all remember, there was a big hiatus in America for a number of years on capital punishment as a number of states, and this is a states' right issue. That's why y'all remember that there's the two sniper guys that were in the D.C. area a few years back, John Lee Malvo, and the other one was Muhammad or whatever. They went around just picking off people, you know, a Home Depot parking lot. Somebody else was just pumping gas. And they did those things in, like, in the D.C. area where there wasn't capital punishment. Later, they traced them back to a earlier death in Georgia. And so there was, like, these states were vying for who gets to them first. And people were hoping that Georgia got to them first because Georgia would execute them, whereas, you know, D.C., they wouldn't. But there was a hiatus so it's state by state. There was a hiatus in America for a number of years on it as different states were appealing the Supreme Court, trying to argue that capital punishment was cruel and unusual punishment and therefore unconstitutional. And that came to an end with the execution of Gary Gilmore by firing squad out in Utah. Some of y'all may remember that this has been decades ago now. The first one after a long time was Gary Gilmore, and they did a firing squad, and they had like four guys, like state troopers, that all like simultaneously shot him, but they did not load the guns. Someone loaded them, so like somebody had a blank, and the other three were live rounds or whatever. So you didn't know if your bullet did it or not. You know, as a way, I guess, to appease the conscience of doing something like that. And I would say, hey, I will be there. I will supply my own ammunition and firearm, and you won't have to put a blank in it. This guy was a scum who murdered and raped women, and daggone it, I'll pull the trigger. I'm sure it would be hard. You might have some nightmares, but so be it. Yeah.
Just a little clarification on something. To take part in the scum, you couldn't be guilty of the same crime as the person that was being stung, or you couldn't be guilty of any crime. Of course, in the case of adultery, if you were stung somebody for adultery, you couldn't be guilty of that same.
I think that or some sort of provision of the law, like a false witness or something. We're going to come back and we'll revisit that, but that's. A lot of times we depict the Pharisees as, you know, real scrupulous, this self-righteous people. I think the Pharisees were downright scoundrels. They were like our politicians who they're in office for their power and for themselves. You know, think about, you know, the Clinton administration with the Clinton Foundation. And I probably, heck, I might be getting in trouble for saying all this stuff. It's, you know, you know, I mean, just downright scoundrels. I mean, how did they know where to find this woman? And the man in this situation was probably one of their own cronies. I think when Jesus said, "You're a wicked and adulterous generation," I think the Pharisees were that way. You know, they were corrupt. They weren't just, you know, real scrupulous, self-righteous people. That, I mean, they conspired against Jesus to have him killed. They started plotting long before he was dead. Yeah.